Okay, Parça Çimeni. And
Yep.
usually Parça Çimeni, I talk about turkeys. And how you can't talk about turkeys because why are turkeys kosher, etc.
Oh, that was
So,
Ethan's big thing.
right. So I remember Ethan came to one of my share and I borrowed his big book of recipes that his like the Avis, his friends did, of all these exotic birds and animals that they all shucked so they can keep a Masorah going. And we've definitely eaten the, I don't know. Yeah, well,
I didn't
the
feel that
last of
bad.
the passenger pigeon or something. But
Oh.
no, we're not going to talk about that. But it is all over the kashrut, okay? And we're going to look at those. We're going to look at the list of birds that are not kosher. And this long list of kashrut, elet shaksu min ha'of. These are the ones you shall find disgusting out of the birds. Lo yochlu sheketzem, yo chelu, rather, they should not be eaten. Sheketzem, they are, how do you want to translate shekets? They're disgusting. And Neshev, the Paris Rosnia, and I won't translate those, but et Tinshamet, with the Kat, with the Racham, long list of names. So Rashi identifies specifically, we're going to look at this Tinshamet. What's a Tinshamet? The answer is Rashi says, based on Gemara, he, Kalvish Schwartz, the in modern French, it would be the Chauvresuris. Chauvresuri, the bat, right? But he describes it, so we know what this animal is, the Domela Achbar. It's a mouse. It's like a mouse that flies at night.
A
Clearly, that's
bat.
a bat, right? But if you look at the list, the problem here is that the tichum is a mina oaf as a kind of bird, and bats aren't birds. Did the Torah not know that? Right? Why are bats in this list of birds?
Well, depends how you define birds.
Exactly. So that's where we're going with this.
Oh,
Right?
okay.
Because we know that, right? You know how we define birds, we would definitely say bats aren't birds, mammals are different birds. So this is an article by Scott Alexander, who I've quoted before. He's a psychiatrist, but he has a lot of smart things to say nonetheless. And he had an article called The Categories Were Made for Man, Not Man for the Categories. I mean, we'd make our definitions. He talks about the bat question, but most of his focus is actually on the whale question. Which is explicit, but the idea that whales aren't kosher, but not because of the rule, but they're not kosher because of the rules for fish, not rules for animals. In other words, whales, mammals in the sea, are considered dog and under that category, not
Okay.
animals. Okay?
But
So
then
the
that's
reason why you can't
kosher.
eat a dolphin is because they don't have scales, not because they don't have hooves, specifically.
Oh.
Okay,
Well.
even though we know that male whales are mammals.
Oh.
As
We
you
say
say,
so.
what?
We say so, but I say whales are sea people.
See things, yes. So that's going to be the point here, that the Torah is making a different distinction. Okay, so he starts with the silliest internet atheist argument is a hotly contested title. I have a special place in my heart for the people who occasionally try to prove biblical fallibility by pointing out that whales are not a type of fish. Okay,
Oh,
because we know that's kind of silly.
right.
Again, bats are not a kind of bird, because you're defining wrong. So he has this wonderful thought experiment. Suppose you travel back in time to ancient Israel and trying to explain to King Solomon that whales are kind of mammal and not a kind of fish. Your translator isn't very good. So you pause to explain fish and mammal to Solomon. You tell him that fish are the sort of thing that herring, bass, and salmon are, and mammal is the sort of thing that cows, sheep, and pigs are. Solomon tells you the word for fish is Hebrew dag, and the word for mammal is Hebrew behemah. I would translate chaya here, but we're close enough. Okay? So you try again and say that a whale is a behemah, not a dog. Solomon laughs at you and says, you're an idiot. Only whales are dog. You explain, you're not an idiot. In fact, all kinds of animals have things that called genes, and genes of a whale are much closer to the be other behemah than those of the dog.
Oh, that's true.
Well, yeah, whales are, that's what it means to be mammals. I mean,
Oh, I thought it had to do with giving birth to young, live
well,
young.
so if I'm going to go there, so yes, so that's cladistics where you look at the characteristics of it as opposed to the DNA, but the DNA is what causes the characteristics.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying? That you have your genes are what make you have those characteristics like having hair and live birth and milk and things like that. Okay, so Whales, they are similar. Okay, so someone said he'd never heard of these gene things before, and then maybe genetics involved in your weird foreign words, fish and mammal, but dog are just fin creatures that swim in the sea, and behemoth are just legged creatures that walk on the earth. You try to explain, no, that Solomon is wrong. Dog is actually defined not by swimming in the sea with finsness, but by their genes. Solomon says, you didn't even know the word dog 10 minutes ago, and now suddenly you think you know what it means better than he does, who's been using his entire life. Who died to make you the expert of biblical Hebrew? You try to explain that whales actually have tiny hairs, too small even to see, just as cows and sheep have hair. Solomon says, and I'm leaving out the, let's see,
They
nah.
do. Whales
You
do
do.
have tiny
Yes,
hair.
they have hair. They are mammals. They have hair just like every like us. Okay. In the original, he has more obscenity in here, but Solomon says, who cares whether whales have tiny little hairs or not? In fact, the only thing Solomon cares about is whether responsibilities for his kingdom production of blubber and whale oil should go under his ministry of Dog or ministry of Behemoth. The ministry of Dog is based on the coast and has lots of people who work on ships. Ministry of Behemoth has a strong presence inland and had lots of people who hunt on horseback. So please, he continues, keep going on how whales have little tiny hairs. It's easy to see that Solomon has a point. And if he wants to define Behemoth as four-legged land dwellers, that's his right, as no better worth than your definition of creatures in a certain part of the phylogenetic tree, like genetics, cladistics, hairs, milk, all that. That is one way to define a set of characteristics, but living on land, having four legs is a reasonable definition. Indeed, it might even be that if you spent 10 years teaching Solomon all about the theory of genetics and evolution, which he's Shlomo, he should figure that out pretty quick, and he and Alexander adds, which would be hilarious. Think how annoyed the creationists would get if we had, a chapter of Sefer Mishlei all about evolution. He might still say, that's very interesting. I can see why we need a word to describe creatures closely related along the phylogenetic tree. But make up your own word because Behemoth already means four-legged land dweller. So, bottom line is that's the same reason you gave why it shouldn't bother you that bats are oaf, even though bats are not birds in the way we use the word bird, but clearly oaf means things that fly, right? So words, the idea is that words represent categories, but things don't fall simply into the categories we want to use. Okay, we get into violent arguments about matters that are just the definition of words. And his point is that that everything that's a category has lots of characteristics that go into it. And things that belong in one category or another are easy, but things that don't fit perfectly, that's more of an arbitrary, what word am I going to use? Fish and mammals differ on a lot of axes, a lot of ways. Fish live in water, they breathe through gills, they have tails and fins. So has a certain hydrodynamic shape, they lay eggs, they're a certain part of the phylogenetic tree in terms of their genetics. Mammals live on land, they breathe through lungs, they have legs, they give live birth, another part of the phylogenetic tree. Most fish conform all to all the fish desiderata, I can't pronounce the word, desiderata, meaning the desired characteristics. Most mammals conform to all the mammal desiderata, so there's no question how to categorize them.
What
Occasionally
is
gets
that word? Wait, what is that word?
desiderata, literally from the
Characteristics?
mean desired thing,
Oh.
mean things I want. These are the things that I want in my mammals, and these are the things I want in my fish.
Oh.
Okay, but you get something weird like a platypus or a lungfish or a whale that doesn't fit in all of those, right? They live in the sea, but they give live birth. They have lungs and hairs, and they, in terms of the genetics, their phylogenetic tree, they belong to the mammals. So. And it's a judgment call we exercise by fiat. You just say it. In our case, meaning in English, the fiat is use genetics and ignore all the characteristics. Some other language, cultural scientific community, might make a different fiat, different
Really?
arbitrary. Like we just said, dog means things that are that swim in the sea.
Right. But do we have any modern languages that have a word?
Or fish.
Yes.
Or well, in modern
Birds.
English, we use the word seafood to include everything that lives in the water.
A whale is seafood?
It is. Not that you would ever eat it, because you have to get your dolphin safe, tuna and all that. But if you were eating it, it would be seafood.
And what's a bird?
In terms of.
Air, fly, goes, lives in
Right,
the
they fly
air.
in the sky. Do we have a single word that covers? things that fly that would include bats and birds and
Okay.
dragonflies. I don't know. But you could have a word
Oh.
for that, right? In fact, the
Yeah.
word "oaf" literally means flying. It's
Oh.
not tzipor, right? So our word "oaf" in the Torah means flying things. And the borders, the characters, we look different. So the philosophical point, we're getting into philosophy here, because we're going to talk about Plato.
Plato.
Okay, the important thing about Plato is that, I think Albert North Whitehead said that all Western philosophy are just a series of footnotes on Plato. Plato is always wrong.
Oh.
But it's worth thinking about it to figure out why. That's my theory of philosophy. Okay, so but Plato has a famously had a theory of forms, this idea of that the philosophical theory of metaphysics developed by Plato, the theory suggests that the physical world is not as real or true as forms. There are ideal forms for everything. There is an ideal chair, and every chair that we see are kind of imperfect variations on that.
Oh, the
There is,
cave, going in the cave and
right, so he also talks about the cave, and we're not seeing the truth, we're just seeing shadows of the truth there, right?
But there is a truth.
There is a truth, and that's this idea, these the ideals. This forms the ideals are the non-physical times, absolute unshakable essence of all things. That there is an essence of bird, there's an essence of whale, there's an essence of fish, and then the real world is kind of just reflections of that, of which objects and matter in the physical world are merely imitations. Okay? Because
So
but
what's
what makes it
wrong? That
it's
sounds
wrong
right.
because there is nothing that,
Oh.
in other words, you can't point, there is nothing that says that is an absolute chair because there are too many boundary things on there. That the essence, what he's calling the essence, is a model, it's a simplification of the infinite complexity of the universe. Right? You can't say there's some ideal chair and then things, because then there are too many things along the border that aren't quite chair. Maybe that's where you could sit on them, but they're not really a chair. It's a sofa, it's a bench, is it there? So if you have a model of reality that your model is the right thing, like this form, the essence, that's the real reality. And then you find that the universe keeps getting things wrong. That's the
Oh.
curse of smart people. Smart people figure things out first, and when they don't work, they blame the universe for getting it wrong. It's a political problem too.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
You
Just
know?
thinking that.
Okay. So stupid people really, oh, that didn't work. I'll do something different. Smart people, oh, that didn't work. I better do it again.
You're flipping it, right?
No, I'm saying that's what I say. Smart people are the
Oh.
ones who say that didn't work. I better do it again. Because
Oh.
the smart people figure it out, and that's got to be right.
Oh.
But no one's
Okay.
smart enough to figure out the universe. Okay. So that there. Right. In other words, this is Korbitsky is a Polish philosopher, early 20th century. Right. The map is not the territory.
A map.
Is not the territory. Right. Whatever your mental model is only a simplification. Okay. The world's more complicated, it's more detailed than that. Right? What you have is a map that, if you're getting lost looking at your map, it's not because the road was wrong. It's because the map was wrong.
Okay.
Okay, and to summarize, sociologist George Box, all models are wrong, but some are useful. So every category we make, we put every animal into a box, into a category. And there's no, it doesn't mean that they're right or wrong. That definition of mammal, dog, fish, behemoth, oaf, bird, that's a definition. So why is that relevant? Why do I care? We're going to have to get into
Okay.
Rav Soloveitchik's philosophy here.
Wow.
Okay, because these forms, these by Plato's ideals, forms, the models we create in our minds to make sense of the observable universe, right? The world's very complicated. We're going to categorize things to simplify it. This is this, this is one of those, this is one of those. So Rav Soloveitchik's philosophy, this is from the halakhic mind, was that the Torah defines its own set of models. Right, these are the categories that you're going to have. And that first of all, halacha was to train our minds to think that way. These are the appropriate sort of mental models. How do you look at the universe? How do you put things together? He was a neo-Kantian. So this is the way he puts it in the halachic mind. And it's very celebrating. It's a lot of big words here. So I love this stuff. So to this end of creating is he's trying to create a Jewish philosophy. There's only a
Maybe there's
single
a seven-letter Scrabble word in here.
I know we got the Weltanschauung. If you can play
Oh,
that,
you need eight
great.
letters, right? You need eight letters.
There's only a single source from which Jewish philosophical Weltanschauung, right, that which means worldview, could emerge. The objective order, the halacha. Halacha determines the forms out of which we create the universe. In passing order onward from the halacha and other objective constructs to a limitless subjective flux, meaning our feelings in the world, the way our senses of the world, that possibly penetrate the basic structures of our religious consciousness, might also evolve cognitive tendencies and aspects to our world and interpretation, and gradually grasp the mysteries of the religious halachic act. New light could be shed on our apprehension of reality. Fancy words. Out of the source of halacha, a new worldview awaits formulation. That's what he wants to use,
But he would say
basically.
halacha is right or wrong. I mean,
Right, that the Torah gives us these models, and that so that this is the way the Torah wants us to formulate the world.
what happens with the idea of elu and different opinions of what is a
That's a perfectly fine way of looking at the world, and that's it is in flux, and there are other ways, lots of ways of looking at it. And that would be saying that both of those are valid ways of putting the world together.
okay.
Okay. I mean that's not a bad thing to have in your what makes the world, that there are lots of ways to look at it and they may be equally valid. So this is the way Hesiod Seltzer, who's a philosophy professor at Queens, I think, or Meir Seltzer's they're brothers. Hesiod and Meir Seltzer are brothers. One of
Oh.
them's a rabbi, one's a philosopher. And they founded the magazine called Hakira, the Torah Journal. So they have an essay about the halachic mind. So sort of the way what this all means here. A halachic person approaches the world with halachic laws a priori to determine how to structure his reality. Imagine a man as steeped in halacha as Rav Soloveitchik, standing in the wilderness. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik describes his uncle, the Brisker Rav, in these terms, as the Ish HaLacha, his book of Ish HaLacha. This
I
halachic
just
man.
heard about when he gave a hespede for that uncle.
Yes.
He was booed and ridiculed.
Really? That's a brilliant essay. I have it. He was booed.
Wait, hespede.
Hespede, right. I mean, the
That's
eulogy,
what
so
I
his
just heard about
eulogy
that.
for Ma Dodecha Midot. I have that hespede. It's talking about what it means to be an ish, a person of halacha. And talking about
Yeah.
this, really looking at the brisk. It's his essay
Well, it
basically on the
was
Brisker method. I did not
an
know that.
uncle, a famous uncle.
I got it. It's got to be the available Brisker.
Yeah, and he was very hurt by it, and he wrote stuff.
That I did not know. So I have read the Hesped of his uncle that I assume that you're talking about, that
Yeah.
I thought was brilliant. So I would personally would not have booed him if that's
Okay.
any solid consolation.
Also, you're polite.
I did not know. I don't. I mean,
Check it out.
I can
I
make.
can't believe anything I say.
I mean,
So,
I can imagine that he would. I just can't imagine anything that he would have said in there that would have been negative. I mean, there are people who disagreed with the Brisker method of learning halacha, treating the halacha as objective, as being the truth of the world, and everything kind of goes subject to that.
no, I think
That was
they,
it was
my
that was inherent in the
understanding
in.
was. They objected to him, like, because he wasn't brisk, or something, or
I
something.
don't know. I don't. I
Okay,
don't. I don't
look
know
into
enough.
it. Yeah.
Do I want to look into it to learn how Jews are being nasty to each other? I see enough of that. I don't need to learn more.
Oh.
I'll believe you, but I won't necessarily.
Okay. I'll
But
probably have to
I
spend a
have deemed
day.
God down the cup to include everybody, and everybody loves everybody else and is willing to listen to everybody, right?
Okay, I'm writing it down.
Anyway, so halachic man looks around. All sorts of sensory input enter his eyes, ears, and nose. His halachic mind takes us all in. He does so. He makes the groupings and distinctions his mind knows how to make. Halachic groupings and distinctions. He notices that there's no trace of an artificially constructed boundary, so he mentally creates a Reshut HaRabim. Okay, that is a concept. That is a word that has no meaning in nor to a normal American, public property means something very different. Rashid Ar-Rahim, like Anthony sees, he notices water collecting the expanse before him is a certain size and also seems to exhibit no trace of having been artificially amassed. He assesses its volume, correlates the information that Lachlan gives him about his water with the water he sees. There's enough water. Lo, this act of assessment creates a mikveh. Okay, this pond is a mikveh, this is not. And similarly, there may be kosher fruits that are not orla, not because they are objectively kosher fruits in nature, because they are material objects that have been cognized, might have been created by thought by someone composed the halakhic structure of pond. That's what it means that these, what Plato called the forms, what Neo-Kantian calls objects or mental objects,
But I
depend on
still
how you look at the world. What?
don't see how it fits into this that someone would say that is our law, that isn't our law. It's 3.5 years. It's
But the very fact that you're making that distinction, that there's a cat there exists a category of fruit that is orla or
okay.
not orla,
Oh,
that is
okay.
a
And you're
concept that
trying
doesn't
to
exist for some of my next door neighbor.
okay.
Okay? They say this is
Got
an
it.
apple, that's an apple. They're both apples. It's like saying this is a fish and that's a fish. And you're saying, no, that's not. That's this is a fish and that's a mammal. I'm saying, no, I have different categories that I'm creating.
I see. Right.
Okay? The halakha
Yeah.
creates categories that wouldn't necessarily exist otherwise. That's a
Creates
philosophical way of looking.
categories.
Okay? So the Torah here is saying this is the way to think about animals, not in terms of phylogeny, parturition, poikilothermy, all those are the good scientific words. My parturition, how they're born, right? Being live. Poikilothermy means being cold-blooded. Phylogeny is where they fit in the genetic tree. We want to think in terms of environment, right? The animals, there are land animals, sky animals, and water animals.
Oh, I like that.
Okay, that's the distinction that the Torah is making in our parsha. Those are the
And
categories.
we are land animals.
Yes, and that's the point thing is that we are land animals.
Right.
So we'll point that out. There's a difference between land animals and the sky and water, because we are in the first category, human beings.
Yeah.
So this gets to a point. So I don't know the Tamei Mitzvah. Okay, I can't tell why the Torah makes these categories. But this is something interesting that Elchanan Samet, the Gush, points out. There's a difference in language. I won't read all of it, but you look at the land animal, right? Dabru b'Yisrael, right? The behema on the land, and this, they split herds, the sheep is tame, the here the gamal, the tamil is tame, the shafan, the rabbit is.
A rabbit is tummy.
The rabbit is right. Shafan is tame. Okay. Where is Shafan? Okay, let's go back here. Okay, the rabbit is tamei, the arne or the shafan, I guess, is the hyrax is tamei, the arnevet is tameya, the chazir is tamei, right? The non-kosher animals are tameim, and the ones, the animals that don't have split hooves, don't, right, are tameim, kol nogea bahem yitma, anyone who touches them becomes tamei, kol echad
Wow.
shepag, animals with paws are tameim. Okay, Noseit Nevatam carrying the corpses, Tameh, Tameim Lachem, and if the kosher animals die without Shechita, the animals you can eat, but they die, if you touch the carcass, Yitma is Tameh, and Ochel, if you're eating an animal that's not kosher, is Tameh, it's Tameh, okay? That's the word to describe the Behemah Asher La'aretz, land animals. The
If you
fish,
touch a dead rabbit, that's tummy.
if you eat a dead rabbit, if you
No,
touch a
touch.
dead cow, that's tame. There are
Oh,
subtleties
dead.
there, okay?
Okay.
In terms of eating versus touching and that. And normally you don't worry about tuma, right? Tuma is only relevant when you're going to the mikdash.
Oh,
You can live your
right.
life being tame.
Okay.
Okay. But zotoklu mikolash ba mayim. Okay, the fish, the sea animals, right? Gotta have fins and scales that are, et cetera, coinage, colache in low, starting up here, baka keset, bachan lim, with, you know, if it doesn't have fins and scales, shekets hu him lachem. It's a shekets. Shekets hu lachem, colache in low, snap your kets, but mayim shekets hu lachem. Okay, similarly, the birds. Elish tishak sumerov, lo yochlu shekets him. Colache of halech labab, insects are shekets. Colache of, you know, bugs, and shiloh arba aglaim that have four legs or more, shekets hulachem. Okay. Land animals are tmeim, sea and sky animals are shekatsim. There are two different reasons for not eating them. Okay. So that's the distinction there. Okay. There are two places where the laws of kashrut are presented. One's here, those are pashut rei in Devarim. Over there, it's all about eating. Doesn't mention that you can't touch them and you'd be tamei at erev and all that. It includes the laws of basar v'chalav over there. Here, it's not about eating. It's fundamentally about tumah tara. Okay, this is vayikra. This is all about who can go into the mikdash in the mishkan, who cannot. Okay, that's what it says in back in parts of vayikra, right? O nefesh yetigah b'chol davar tamei, o nivleyat chayat tameya. Oh, benivlat behemat tmeya, oh, benivlat sheretz tamei. So if you touch any of these animals that are tmeim, and then you forget, then you v'ashem, you do the wrong thing, Rashi says, lachatuma hazu, and after becoming tamei, yochlu kodashim, you eat a karban, oh, you can ask the mikdash, you go into the mishkan mikdash, that's asham, that's what you're doing wrong. Okay? That's tuma. The fish, the birds, the sky animals, and sea animals don't have tumah. You're not allowed to eat them. They're shekets, they're gross, don't eat them. But they have nothing to do with tumah. You eat them, you can still go into the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? There are two different reasons. There's sherets and there's tameh. So I can't explain to you the sherets. Why there's a concept of sherets, because obviously people like lobsters and oysters and all of that. That why the Torah would say not to. But I'll see at least this idea of tumah. Again, only applies to the at land animals. Okay? It doesn't apply to bugs, right? We're looking at the parsha here. And the reason that Rav Samet puts, and that's from Hirsch, is because we are land animals. This is our group. We're similar to that. Because tuma is a mental concept. Tuma is memento mori, a reminder of death. The ultimate tumah is a human dead body, right? Okay, and Hirsch says that tumah, that once we have this concept of death, that reminder is incompatible with being free, our free will of Avodat Hashem. That's the way he puts it. It's only the death of the creatures who live near and among human beings. Again, the land animals. It's not what they look like. It's the fact that they're one of us. Yamdi is important, can't transmit tumah. Creatures whose lives are considered of lesser value reside far away from human residence or activities, such as fish and birds, do not generate impurity on their demise. The death of a human being generates the most severe tumah, right? That you're tamei for a week and you need the paraduma. Person's death is the strongest source of ritual impurity. Next comes the large land-dwelling mammals with whom man shares the earth. That's Hirsch was one who says that. That the idea of moral responsibility will be endangered by the fact that man must submit to death and to the superficial limitations with the forces of nature exert on everything, including human beings. The dead human being lying before our eyes demonstrates so radically. That's the whole point of Kohelet. If I die, what's the point? I can't serve Hashem if I'm focused on being dead. Like I'm going to end. I'm just this piece of meat. That's what tumah represents. Like not that I can't avoid it. It's part of life. It's true. It's not a bad thing, but it's not consistent with the Mikdash. If the whole human being is condemned to death, then altogether nowhere is there a place for the moral thou shalt next to the physical thou must. So the way Rabbi Eldrastein summarizes this idea that the forms of tumah from our parsha function through their mental associations. And only the context of entering the mikdash and functioning within the requirements of its offerings. The Torah effect warrants that contact with various dead animals sets us thinking in a manner that is inconsistent with the essential message of the Mikdash, striving to achieve the highest spiritual plane available to man. This kind of tumah is decidedly impermanent. For us, it is symbolic. We feel its impact only when it is immediately associated with the Mikdash.
So once the Mikdash was destroyed, we no more tumah.
It's not the tumah, right? We are all walking around being tameh, right? We don't have the parah adumah. We may go to a mikvah, but that's not. We don't walk around with any consciousness of tumah. Let's put it that way.
No, we don't.
We don't, and that's true. In general, laws of
Because
contact.
it was part of their daily life back then, I guess. Could they go
Yes.
in the mikdash? Could they not go in? And now we don't
Right.
have the mikdash.
If you're learning chagiga and you got to pay attention to what you're holding, and you know whether you're picking this thing up with a plea or not, there are all sorts of laws there that just have no relationship to our lives right now.
Right. But kosher and treif,
very much apply.
right.
But we're
They're not
saying that.
synonymous with tamei and tahor,
Well,
kosher
that
and treif.
again, in our parsha, we have the tamei animals and the tahor, which is synonymous. We can't eat those, but also the sheketz. The sheketz is also not kosher.
Right.
Okay, we use two different words to describe the things we don't eat. One is the tamei, for which we don't eat them, but the tuma side of it specifically isn't relevant. So,
You can see someone veering off from this into vegetarianism, like
yes, you could. I mean,
we're
I don't.
land animals, and yeah.
Okay, and you know, that's an argument for being a pescatarian as well, or an
But
ovitarian.
they're sea people, not land things.
Animals, right. Right, so I'm saying
And
is it's further away from us. So you can argue that it would be more. It would be better to eat those the sea and the sky animals than the land animals. You
a
could make such
mermaid
an argument.
would be a problem.
What?
A mermaid would be a problem.
Don't eat mermaids. That's just general advice, okay? I'm gonna say do not eat the mermaids.
Just in case.
Okay, so in general, the laws of contact tuma keep us away from most insidious medicines of death. When we witness death, we're likely at some level to absorb the idea that we're nothing but material, programmed to live and die by random laws of nature. If we're nothing but the dross of an unseeing universe, then we enjoy no moral freedom to make choices and assume responsibility for our inner lives and stature. Contact tuma, as we talked about here, applies to large animals, the mammals that we most resemble, that live in close proximity to man. That's the message
So
here and there.
we should translate the word oaf. We should just say oaf.
That's a perfectly reason. That's you know, that's what Alexander does with dog and behema. So those
Yeah.
are words, and if you translate
Right.
as fish and mammal, then you're going to make mistakes.
Right. So this oaf and this dog, you know, that's,
Okay. So I'll say
yeah.
that. Bats are not birds, but tichamet is an oaf.
It's an oaf.
It's an oaf.
Right.
Okay. So
That's
it
a
represents
bird.
a different
Right.
way of looking at the world around us. So it's telling us this is a way to look at the world around us that has its own value there.
This is very heady.
It's pretty deep. Yeah, as soon as we get to the Rosh Hashanah, the halachic mind, it gets really deep. But the bottom line is that oaf doesn't necessarily mean bird. Words mean different things depending on, and then the words are part of the, reflect the way we look at the world.
And halacha is the
The
standard
Torah's
of
way
everything.
of looking at the world.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're arguing that that is a good thing to be looking at the world in this way.
This is hard.
It is.
Wow.
I mean, right. We're bringing both Soloveitchik and Plato into here. I mean, this is going to be impossible.
So this is philosophy, yeah?
Yeah. Yes. And the other lesson is that Plato is always wrong, but it's worth figuring out why. I will stop here.
And this is Shemini. Okay.
Kosher animals. Bats are not kosher. That's the bottom line.
Bats are not
Kosher.
They're shickets.
They're not, right, but they're shekets, right? They're not tamei.
They're not tummy. They're not kosher. They're shickets. All right. Well.
Okay. I'm going to end here. Have a good day. I guess Davita's sleeping in. That's
Okay.
okay. Hope your tooth feels
Okay.
better.
Yeah, it's all right.
Oh, I do always ask then, what time is it?
What time is it here?
Yeah, it's
6:40.
2:30.
What?
It's 2:30. It's two
Ah!
thirty. Okay, I will end there.
Okay.
Uh,
Good. Bye.